Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into, well, it's one of the great puzzles in art history, really. We're trying to piece together the life, the identity of a painter who, for a while, was arguably the most important artist in Europe.
We're talking about Rogier van der Weyden. And it's fascinating because, you know, his fame back then, it was immense. He actually overshadowed Jan van Eyck for a time, got commissions from kings, dukes, the whole European elite.
But then somehow, by the mid-18th century, he's almost completely forgotten, vanished from the history books, practically.
It is just an incredible story, almost unbelievable, this kind of historical amnesia. And the detective work involved in bringing him back. Because you look at his status in the 15th century, he's a foundational figure, one of the Vlaamse Primitieum, the early Netherlandish masters.
Right.
But almost everything we know today is pieced together from, well, fragments, scattered civic records, stylistic analysis. It's like reconstructing a giant mosaic with half the tiles missing.
So that's our mission today, isn't it? We're pulling together these scattered facts. We want to trace his life, understand his incredible international success, and really unpack the, what, century-long confusion that basically buried his identity and his work.
Yeah, we're going deep into the archives, figuratively speaking, trying to figure out how someone that famous could just disappear.
And we have to start right at the beginning with the most base confusion, his name.
Exactly, because that's where the puzzle really begins. How does one person end up known by two completely different names, Rogier de la Pasture and Rogier van der Weyden?
And how did that simple linguistic split manage to obscure who he was for so incredibly long?
Let's get right into that. The names aren't that different if you think about the meaning.
Pasture and Weyden both mean meadow or pasture land, right? One's French, one's Flemish.
Precisely. And that tells you everything about his geography and his career moves. So we know he was born Rogier de la Pasture. That's the French version.
Yeah.
And he was born in Tournai,
which is in modern day Belgium and was a really important artistic center back then.
Absolutely crucial. And this was around 1399 or 1400. So the French name reflects the language spoken in Tournai at the time.
And his background, we know he wasn't like from peasant stock.
Definitely not. His father, Henri de la Pasture, he was a maître coutelier.
A master cutler, like making high-end knives and tools.
Exactly. So a respected, successful artisan family. It gives young Rogier a solid foundation. And later, we know he married Elizabeth Goffert. Her father was a shoemaker, but from Brussels.
Okay, so connecting him to Brussels early on, even through marriage.
Right, and they officially settled in Brussels.
Mm.
The records show that by October 1435, they're there. They were probably established there a bit before that, but that's the official date we have.
And they had children who survived, which was quite something back then.
Four children, yes. Cornelius, who became a Carthusian monk, so a religious path, then Margaretha, and then two younger ones, Peter and Jan, who were born after the move to Brussels.
And significantly, Peter became a painter and Jan a goldsmith.
It really shows the family embedding itself into the artistic and professional life of Brussels, doesn't it? And this move, this settling in Brussels, that's the trigger point for the name change.
Right. He moves from French-speaking Tournai to the Duchy of Brabant, where Brussels was the main city.
And where Flemish was the language of administration, of daily life, for many. So, almost automatically, Rogier de la Pasture gets translated into its Flemish equivalent, Rogier van der Weyden.
So it wasn't him trying to hide or anything complicated. It was just bureaucracy, linguistic reality.
Pretty much. Standard practice when you move between linguistic regions. But this clarity about the name change just throws the next part into sharper relief. The really confusing stuff about his apprenticeship. This is the bit that gets scholars really animated.
The aha moment, or maybe the ha moment.
The ha moment.
Right.
Because the records from Tournai, they just don't line up with how apprenticeships normally worked.
Okay, lay it out for us. What's the timeline problem?
Okay, so November 17th, 1426, there's a record. The city council of Tournai honors a maître Rogier de la Pasture. They give him this gift, 8 pitchers of wine.
Which sounds like a pretty big deal back then, a public honor.
It really was. It strongly suggests he's already recognized as a master. Maestro usually means master, either in a craft or maybe even academically. He's got status.
Okay, so he's a master in 1426, but then...
But then, less than 6 months later, March 5th, 1427, the records show a Rogier de la Pasture. Note the slightly different spelling, maybe indicating younger status, or maybe just inconsistency formally entering the workshop of Robert Kempen as an apprentice, a disciple.
Wait, he goes from being honored as a master to starting an apprenticeship at nearly 30 years old.
Exactly. And he's apprenticing alongside Jacques Duret. And it gets even weirder. The records show he only officially gets the title of Master Painter from the Guild 5 years later, in 1432.
So let me get this straight. Honored as Maestre in 1426, starts as an apprentice in 1427, officially becomes a Master Painter in 1432. That's completely backwards.
It totally inverts the usual path. Normally you apprentice, then you become a master, then maybe you get honored by the city council.
So what's the explanation? If he's already a recognized master, why go back to square one apprenticing under Campan? Was Campan just that prestigious? Or was it some kind of legal loophole?
Well, Campan was incredibly prestigious, let's be clear. A major figure. But most scholars think it was probably more about the legal side, tied to the situation in Tournai at the time.
How so?
Tournai was apparently going through some serious crises in the 1420s.
Mm-hmm.
Political turmoil, economic problems, and the guilds, the craft organizations, they weren't functioning properly. Their rules were maybe in flux, or records weren't being kept right.
Okay, so the apprenticeship might not have been about learning painting skills he probably already had.
Exactly. It might have been more of a legal formality.
Yeah.
A way to get the official guild paperwork sorted out, maybe under Campan's established authority, because the normal process was broken. It's like needing a specific certification to practice legally, even if you're already an expert.
Mm-hmm.
Administrative theater, as you said.
That makes a certain kind of sense. What about the other theory? That the Wine of Honor in 1426 was for something else, like an academic degree?
That's another possibility people raise. Maybe the Maester title wasn't for painting, but for, say, a Master of Arts degree. It's speculative. There's no direct record saying he got a degree.
But it fits with the kind of art he made later.
It does seem to fit, yes. His work is often incredibly sophisticated intellectually. The complex symbols, the way he arranges figures, the sheer emotional depth.
Yeah.
It feels like the work of someone with a broader education than just craft training. So an academic title could explain that. And also why the city honored him before his official painting apprenticeship.
Either way, whether it was legal necessity or prior academic achievement, the link to Robert Campan is solid.
Oh, absolutely. The stylistic connection is undeniable. You look at the works of Jacques Daret, his fellow apprentice under Campan, and you see this clear family resemblance between Campan's work, Daret's work, and Roger's early paintings. The way they handle figures, light, drapery, it's all connected. Roger was definitely Campan's pupil.
But he didn't stay in his shadow for long.
Not at all. And this is what's really remarkable. The analysis suggests Roger quickly surpassed Campan. He outshone his master, as the source says. And even more surprisingly, Roger seems to have later influenced Campan's own later style.
The student influencing the teacher, that's rare.
Incredibly rare. It just shows how rapidly Roger developed his own powerful, distinctive vision. He absorbed the lessons, then forged something new and compelling, so much so that even his own master took notice and adapted.
Okay, so Roger navigates this apprenticeship maze in Tournai, gets his official master painter status, and then makes the big move to Brussels around 1435. And this isn't just changing cities, it's like flipping a switch on his career. It just takes off.
Instantly. I mean, the very year he settles there, 1435, he lands this incredibly prestigious job, official painter to the town of Brussels, the Stadtschilder.
And we really need to stress how important Brussels was at this moment. This wasn't some minor town.
Not at all. It was the main residence of the Dukes of Burgundy. We're talking about the court of Philip the Good. This was arguably the most powerful, wealthy, and culturally sophisticated court in all of Europe in the 15th century. Think extravagance, think influence, think artistic patronage on a grand scale.
So getting the city painter job there, that's major league.
It's huge. And the position itself seems to have been created specifically for him. It wasn't like they were just filling a vacancy. They wanted Roger van der Weyden.
And the plan was for the job to just end when he died.
Apparently so.
Hmm.
It shows how much they valued him personally. They weren't just hiring a functionary. They were securing the services of a superstar for the city's image and prestige.
And this status, this official position, it clearly translated into financial success. The records show he was doing very well for himself.
Oh, definitely. We have documents showing he owned properties, made investments. He accumulated significant wealth, which tells you the demand for his paintings among the elite must have been intense. He was clearly charging top prices and getting them.
But he wasn't just hoarding his wealth. There's evidence of philanthropy, too.
Yes, and that's important for understanding his social standing. He wasn't just seen as a craftsman. Records confirm he gave generously to the poor. And between 1455 and 1457, he actually served as an administrator for a local hospital and charitable foundation called Turkistan.
So, managing charity funds, taking on civic responsibilities, that suggests a higher status, right? More than just a painter for hire.
Exactly. It points to him being a respected member of the community, perhaps bridging that gap between artisan and, well, maybe something closer to the intellectual class. It fits with that earlier idea of a possible academic background, too.
Now let's talk about who is buying his paintings. We know he's tight with the Burgundian court.
Yes, Philip the Good himself, his family members, the courtiers, that was his home base, his primary network, painting their portraits, creating devotional works for them, that secured his local power base.
But his client list went way beyond Burgundy. This is where his international fame really kicks in.
Absolutely. His reputation just exploded across Europe. We know for a fact his works were being exported very early on to major centers like Italy and Spain. We're talking about foreign aristocrats, royalty.
And we have concrete examples, like the Miraflores altarpiece.
That's a key piece of evidence. Commissioned by King Juan II of Castile, the King of Spain. He then donates it to the Miraflores Monastery near Burgos in 1445.
And the crucial part is the paperwork survived.
The deed of gift, yes. And it explicitly describes the altarpiece as the work of the great and famous Flandresco Roquel. So there you have it, a royal document from 1445, authenticating a specific work and confirming his international fame under his name. It's gold dust for art historians.
His connections in Italy are also really telling. There's mention he might have gone to Rome, maybe for the Jubilee year in 1450.
Yes, there's a strong possibility he made a pilgrimage to Rome around 1450. He might have been in Italy a bit earlier, too, perhaps 1449. But what's really interesting is the analysis suggests this trip. It didn't really change his painting style.
Which is kind of counterintuitive. You'd think going to Italy, seeing Italian Renaissance art, would have a massive impact.
You would, wouldn't you? But it seems Rogier was already such a dominant artistic force, so confident in his own style, that he wasn't really looking for new influences. He was arriving in Italy not as a student, but as a celebrated master whose work was already known and admired there. His influence was already flowing south.
And we know the biggest names in Italy were patrons. The Este family in Ferrara, the Medici in Florence.
Exactly. These weren't minor nobles. They were the absolute power players, the driving forces behind the Italian Renaissance. And they were actively commissioning and collecting Rogier van der Weyden. They saw his northern realism and emotional intensity as something essential, something powerful.
Nothing quite demonstrates his status like that story about the Duchess of Milan, though. Bianca Maria Visconti.
Ah, yes, the Zanetto Bugatto incident. It's just astonishing when you break it down.
So the Duchess of Milan wants her court painter, this guy Zanetto Bugatto, to get some training from the best. She wants him to apprentice with Rogier in Brussels.
Right. But apparently, Rogier is either too busy or perhaps just not inclined to take on another apprentice easily. So what happens?
The Duchess has to pull strings, big strings. She gets the Duke of Burgundy involved, she gets the Dauphin of France, the future King Louis VIII involved. They both apparently have to write letters, use their diplomatic influence.
Just to persuade Rogier van der Weyden to accept one apprentice from the Milanese court into his workshop.
It's unbelievable leverage for an artist.
It really is. It tells you he wasn't just an artist. He was operating at the level of international diplomacy. His workshop, his time, his teaching. It was a valuable commodity that required negotiation between rulers.
That completely explains why the Italian scholars, the humanists like Filarete and Bartolomeo Fascio, were writing about him in such glowing terms in the 1450s and 60s.
Calling him the greatest, the most noble of painters. It wasn't just hype. His reputation was genuinely immense, built on these kinds of high-level connections, and of course, the power of the art itself.
Okay, so we've established his incredible status. Let's talk about the paintings themselves. What actually defines the van der Weyden style? What makes his work so distinctive and influential?
Well, I think the first thing that strikes you is this unique combination of intense emotion, real pathos, and sharp naturalism.
He's observing from life, right? Using models.
Absolutely, meticulously. You see incredible detail in textures, fabrics, faces. It feels very real, very observed. But he doesn't just copy reality, he heightens it, especially the emotion. His figures, particularly in religious scenes like the Crucifixion or the Lamentation, they express profound grief.
Tears, dramatic gestures.
Yes, but crucially, they always maintain a sense of dignity, a kind of statuesque gravity, even in their sorrow. It's not uncontrolled hysteria, it's deep, resonant human suffering presented with artistic control.
You mentioned statuesque. That's a recurring description for his figures, isn't it?
It is, particularly in his larger works, the triptychs. The figures have a solidity, a sculptural quality. They feel substantial, weighty. This gives his compositions a kind of monumental feeling, even when depicting intense movement or emotion.
And color. His use of color is often highlighted.
Oh, definitely. He uses rich, warm colors, often quite saturated. But it's not just bold color, it's incredibly nuanced. Combined with the expressions, it creates this very sympathetic feeling, drawing you right into the scene.
And technically, there's something specific about his tonal range.
Yes, this is where you see the real technical mastery. He used an unusually wide variety of tones within a single painting. Experts who've studied his best works closely point out that he rarely repeats the exact same shade or tone twice on the canvas.
Even for something like white cloth.
Even the whites. If you look at, say, the different linens or garments in The Descent from the Cross, each white area is subtly different, varied in tone. It avoids any flatness, any visual boredom. That level of control over color and light is just extraordinary. It shows a profound understanding of optics. Almost obsessive attention to detail.
Now, besides the big religious works, he was also a master portraitist. That requires a different skill set, doesn't it? Especially when painting the powerful elite.
Completely different. Portraiture for clients like the Burgundian court wasn't just about likeness. It was about image crafting, about propaganda, really.
Flattery was part of the job description.
Absolutely. The goal, as one source puts it, was to give the sitter a handsomeness or beauty or interest or intelligence they might not have been blessed with in life. Harsh, but probably true.
So how did he achieve that? What were his techniques for idealizing his sitters?
Well, he typically used the half-length, half-profile format. It's intimate, but still formal. And then he'd subtly refine their features.
Like adjusting the facial structure.
Exactly. He often enlarged the eyes slightly, making the sitter look more intense, more intelligent, maybe more soulful. He would sharpen the contours of the face, giving it better definition. And a really common trick seems to have been strengthening the jawline.
Ah, the strong jawline. Yeah. Signifies authority, confidence.
Precisely. It gives that sense of aristocratic bearing, of power and decisiveness, regardless of what the person actually looked like. It's this combination of subtle adjustments that creates that idealized, powerful presence you see in his famous portraits.
Like Philip the Good, his wife Isabella of Portugal, or their son, Charles the Bold. You look at those portraits and you see power.
Exactly. That's the image he was paid to create.
Now, despite this incredible output and skill, we keep coming back to the fact that pinning down specific works definitively is tricky. But we do have some anchors. You mentioned The Descent from the Cross earlier.
Yes. That's considered the defining work, probably painted around 1435, right as he's moving to brothels. It's the painting that really announced his arrival as a major force, perhaps the most influential northern painting of its time. Its emotional power, the composition, it set a benchmark.
And then there's that fascinating case of the painting that got cut up, the Magdalen Reading.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Magdalen Reading. It's now in the National Gallery in London, and it's just exquisite, a fragment. Showing Mary Magdalene deeply absorbed in a book. It's considered one of the absolute jewels of 15th century painting, the detail, the calm intensity, the light. It's breathtaking.
But for centuries, it was just that, a beautiful fragment.
Exactly, an isolated piece. But then, through some brilliant art historical detective work, mostly in the later 20th century, scholars started noticing connections. They looked at the wood grain, the scale, the style.
And linked it to other fragments.
And two small heads, one of St. Catherine and one of St. Joseph, which are now in the Gulbenkian Museum in Lisbon, Portugal. By analyzing the wood and the composition, they proved conclusively that the London Magdalen and the two Lisbon heads were all originally part of the same, much larger altarpiece.
Wow. So a big painting, probably depicting the Virgin and Child with various saints, was just chopped up.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah.
Dismembered and sold off as smaller, more marketable pieces sometime before 1811. It's a tragic story of an artwork's destruction, but also a triumph of scholarship, literally piecing the evidence together across museums in different countries to understand the original work.
It's a reminder of how much might have been lost, which brings us to the biggest loss of all, the work that should have guaranteed his fame forever, the Brussels Town Hall Commission.
The Justice of Trajan and Herkenwald. Yes, this was his massive civic project. Commissioned for the Golden Khmer, the Golden Chamber of the Brussels Town Hall.
And when you say massive, you mean?
We're talking colossal for panel painting at that time. Four huge panels, each one likely measured about 4.5 meters high, maybe 15 feet. Just imagine lining a room with paintings that size.
Incredible. And they weren't just decoration, were they? They had a specific purpose.
A very important civic function. They depicted historical and legendary examples of justice stories about the Roman Emperor Trajan and a local duke, Herkenbold, rendering impartial justice. They were meant as moral guides, as reminders, for the aldermen and judges who conducted city business and dispensed justice in that very room.
When did he paint these?
He worked on them over a period, likely between 1439 and the early 1440s, maybe finishing around 1450. And we know he signed at least two of the panels.
So a signed, monumental, centrally located, officially commissioned work, how could that not secure his legacy?
Because it was destroyed. Utterly obliterated.
When? How?
During the French bombardment of Brussels in 1695, Louis XIV's troops bombarded the city, causing catastrophic fires that destroyed a huge part of the historic center, including the town hall and these masterpieces inside it. Gone forever.
So we only know about them from written descriptions.
Primarily, yes. People who saw them before 1695 wrote about them. Albrecht Dürer famously saw them on his visit in 1520 and was apparently deeply impressed. Vasari mentioned them too. And we have some visual evidence from later copies, most notably a large tapestry now in Bern, Switzerland, which copies parts of the compositions.
But the originals lost. It's hard not to think how different things might have been if that work had survived. It was irrefutable proof of his genius, right there in the heart of Brussels.
Exactly. That destruction created a huge void. You take away his most visible documented public work, you add the confusion over his name we talked about, and suddenly it becomes much easier for his identity and body of work to get muddled over time. That's really the seed of the attribution crisis.
This centuries-long confusion where historians just couldn't quite figure out who painted what or even who he was.
Right, because for a long time, there wasn't a single surviving painting that could be absolutely 100% tied to him, based only on documents from the 15th century itself. The links were often circumstantial or came from later records.
So modern scholarship had to basically rebuild his catalog from the ground up, using a few key works as anchors.
Precisely. The work of scholars like Lauren Campbell and Dirk DeVos has been crucial here. They focused on identifying the handful of works where the provenance, the chain of ownership and documentation was strongest. These became the touchstones.
And which ones are they? The core authenticated works.
There are three main ones that are generally accepted as the bedrock. First, The Descent from the Cross, the one now in the Prado Museum in Madrid.
That's the one with the amazing survival story, right?
That's the one. Its history is incredibly well documented, tracing back through Spanish royal collections from the 16th century. And yes, the story is that when the ship carrying it to Spain was wrecked, the panel itself was packed so well, probably in a waterproof crate, that it actually floated and was recovered largely undamaged.
Incredible. A testament to good packing, I guess.
And maybe a sign of its perceived importance even then. It certainly added to its mystique.
Okay, so that's number one. What's the second?
The second is the Triptych of the Virgin, which is also known as the Mare Flores altarpiece. The one we mentioned earlier, now in Berlin.
Commissioned by the King of Spain.
Exactly. And the key here is that 1445 deed of gift from King Juan II, specifically naming the artist as the great and famous Flandresco Rogel. That contemporary royal documentation is incredibly strong.
And the third anchor piece.
That's the Crucifixion Triptych, which is now in the Escorial Palace near Madrid. Its provenance connects it directly back to Rogier himself. It was documented as a donation by Rogier to the Charterhouse of Chute, a monastery just outside Brussels where he had connections, possibly where his son Cornelius was a monk.
So these three works, the Prado Descent, the Berlin Mare Flores, and the Escorial Crucifixion, they form the undisputed core.
They form the foundation upon which the rest of his attributed work is largely built, using stylistic comparison and other slightly less direct evidence. They are the fixed points.
Okay, so with these anchors established now, let's go back and trace how the confusion got so bad before this clarity emerged. How did historians actually manage to lose track of this guy?
It really started with a simple but hugely influential mistake made by Giorgio Vasari.
The Italian art historian. His Lives of the Artists from 1568 was like the Bible of art history for centuries.
Exactly. And Vasari, writing about this famous Flemish painter, mistakenly called him Ruggiero da Brugia. Rogier of Bruges.
Wrong city. Van der Weyden was based in Brussels, not Bruges.
Completely wrong city. But because Vasari was so influential, that geographical error stuck. It planted the idea that the great Rogier was associated with the Bruges.
So then when later historians like the Dutch writer Karel van Mender came along.
Right. Van Mender, writing his Schilder book in 1604, he knew that the famous painter Rogier van der Weyden lived and worked in Brussels. He had local knowledge, Brussels records.
So he had conflicting information. Vasari saying Bruges, his own sources saying Brussels.
Exactly. And Vermeer couldn't easily reconcile it. Maybe he thought Vary couldn't possibly be wrong. So he came to what seemed like a logical conclusion at the time, but was historically disastrous.
He decided there must be two different painters.
Yes. He basically listed them separately. He essentially concluded there must have been two major artists, both named Rogier, one based in Bruges, following Vasari, and one based in Brussels. The identity was officially split in two.
Wow. Just based on one geographical mistake by Vasari. It's like a game of historical telephone.
Really is. One error gets repeated, then interpreted, then leads to another layer of confusion. And it didn't stop there. It got even more complicated.
How?
Well, later on in the 19th century, an archivist found some records suggesting that the Brussels Rogier, our Rogier, had died earlier than people had previously thought. This messed up Van Mander's timeline even more.
So now the dates don't fit either Van Mander theory.
Right. Which led another historian, Alfred Mickels, to propose yet another theory. He suggested there were two painters, but maybe it was a father and son, both named Rogier, working one after the other.
Okay, so now we potentially got Rogier of Bruges, Rogier of Brussels, father, and Rogier of Brussels, son. Three Rogier.
It was getting completely out of hand.
Yeah.
And then to add one final layer of stylistic confusion, the whole Maître de Flamel issue emerged.
Oh, the Master of Flamel. This was an anonymous name given to a group of paintings, right?
Yes. In the late 19th century, art historians grouped together these powerful, quite realistic paintings, often with robust sculptural figures in detailed domestic settings. And since they didn't know the artist, they gave him this name, the Master of Flamel, based on a mistaken provenance for some of the works.
And how did that connect to Rogier?
Because stylistically, these Flamel works shared certain qualities with Rogier's known early paintings. That intense realism, the emotional way, the northern character, there was clearly a connection.
So people started thinking, maybe the Master of Flamel was Rogier, just an earlier phase of his work.
That was a dominant theory for quite a while. It seemed plausible that this powerful, slightly rougher style was Rogier before he developed his more elegant, refined manner. It muddied the waters even further, trying to define Rogier's early development.
What was the key difference stylistically that eventually helped separate them?
Well, the Flamel works, which we now know are by Robert Campa and his teacher, they tend to have heavier, more block-like figures, very sculptural, very solid, often packed into quite crowded, detailed spaces. Rogier, even early on, tends to streamline those forms a bit, makes them more elongated, more graceful, and injects that distinctive, refined pathos, that elegant sorrow. But the overlap, especially in their shared focus on realism, made it hard to untangle for decades.
So who finally cut through all this confusion? The multiple Rogier, the Flamel mix-up?
It happened in stages. A big breakthrough came in 1913. The Belgian scholar Georges Hulin de Lou convincingly argued, and eventually proved, that the Master Flamel was, in fact, Robert Campin, Rogier's teacher.
Okay, so that removed one layer of confusion. Campin was Campin, not Rogier.
Right. And then the final synthesis, the grand unification, really came with Erwin Panofsky.
The famous art historian, his big book on early Netherlandish painting.
Exactly. Published in 1953. Panofsky meticulously reviewed all the evidence, the names, the dates, the stylistic links, Vasari's error, Van Mander's confusion, the Campin connection, and he laid out the definitive case. Despite all the historical noise, all the records ultimately pointed to one single monumental artist.
Rogier de la Pasture, born in Tournai, who became Rogier van der Weyden when he moved to Brussels. One man, two names.
One man, two names. Panofsky finally put the ghost of multiple Rogiers to rest.
It's just amazing it took until the mid-20th century to definitively sort that out. But now that he's been, well, historically reassembled, his importance is undeniable. He's considered the most influential northern painter of the entire 15th century.
Without a doubt. His impact was just enormous. That style we talked about, that vigorous, subtle, expressive painting, as the sources call it, it just spread everywhere.
Across northern Europe, obviously.
Deep into France, Germany. Carried by artists who trained with him or saw his work or saw copies. But also, as we saw, significantly into Spain and Italy, thanks to those high-level commissions and his sheer reputation, he essentially set the template for religious emotion in northern art for generations.
And it wasn't just his overall style. He actually introduced specific new ways of depicting things, new iconographies.
Yes, he was a real innovator in terms of what was painted and how. Panofsky highlights a couple of key things. First, Rogier really pushed the idea of depicting patrons within the sacred scene. not just kneeling off to the side, but sometimes actually participating in the event, like in the Madonna and Child with Saints fragments we discussed. It blurred the lines between the viewer's world and the holy past,
making religion more immediate, more personal.
Exactly. And related to that, he popularized a specific format, the devotional diptych.
Two panels hinged together.
Right. Typically, one panel would show the Virgin Mary, often half-length, sometimes nursing the Christ child, and the other panel would be a portrait of the person who commissioned it, shown in prayer, facing the Virgin.
Ah, creating this very direct personal connection between the worshiper and the divine.
Precisely. It was a portable, intimate format for private devotion, and it became incredibly popular thanks to Roget. He essentially standardized it.
And even influenced how specific saints or stories were depicted.
Yes, down to the details. The example given is Saint Jerome pulling the thorn from the lion's paw. It wasn't a new story, but Roget seems to have reformulated it, given it a particularly compelling visual form that then got copied widely. He had a knack for creating these definitive images.
So his influence flowed through his own workshop, obviously, but also through other artists who copied or adapted his style.
Definitely. His workshop must have been highly productive, training assistants and spreading his methods. While proving direct master-pupil relationships is often tricky with the records we have, Hans Memling is usually considered his greatest successor.
Even if we can't definitively prove Memling studied directly under Roget.
Right. The documentation isn't airtight. Mm-hmm. But stylistically, Memling clearly inherits Roget's grace, his compositional sense, his approach to portraiture. He carries that torch forward. But maybe even more important for spreading the style widely was Martin Schongauer.
The German engraver?
Yes. Schongauer was a brilliant painter and engraver, and he deeply admired van der Weyden. He translated Roget's compositions, his figure types, his emotional intensity into copperplate engravings.
Which could be printed and distributed far and wide.
Exactly. Engravings were like the mass media of the 15th century. Schongauer's prints circulated all over Europe, Germany, France, Italy, Spain. They were hugely influential, ensuring that the van der Weyden look became the dominant visual language across the North, even for artists who never saw an original painting.
It's incredible. The source material suggests that basically every major Northern artist of the later 15th century, except maybe Petrus Christus, who followed Van Eyck, shows some trace of Roget's influence.
It's a powerful claim, but it speaks to just how foundational his art became. He set the agenda.
And yet, we have to come back to this baffling mystery. Despite being the dominant influence, setting the style for a century, his fame just evaporates.
It's one of the strangest trajectories in art history. As we said, he actually eclipsed Van Eyck in popularity during his own lifetime and for decades after. His fame was solid through the 15th, 16th, even into the early 17th century.
But then?
Then tastes change. Dramatically, the High Renaissance in Italy, then the Baroque. The artistic mood shifts. European taste moves away from Roget's intense Gothic pathos, his sharp realism combined with spiritual intensity. They start favoring maybe more classical balance, more overt drama of the Baroque, different kinds of subjects.
His style just fell out of fashion completely.
So completely that by the mid-1700s, he was, as the sources say, almost totally forgotten. It wasn't just that his name was confused. People just weren't looking at his kind of art anymore. It seemed old-fashioned, maybe too severe or too overtly emotional in a way they didn't appreciate.
So it took another couple of centuries for that appreciation to return.
Yes. Basically, the 19th and early 20th centuries, starting with scholars digging in archives, rediscovering records, then the careful stylistic analysis, the untangling of the Campan connection, and finally, Panofsky's synthesis. It was a slow, painstaking process, piece by piece, to rebuild his reputation and understand his true significance. Hashtag outro, Gabens.
So when you pull it all together, what's the takeaway on Roger van der Weyden? We followed him from Tournai with that confusing apprenticeship and the name change to becoming the star painter of Brussels, the Staatsschilder dealing with kings and dukes across Europe.
He was a master of technique, that incredible color, the way he conveyed deep emotion, the subtle flattery in his portraits. But his phenomenal success, his international status, it all got buried under layers of historical accidents. Confused records, Vasari's mistake, the destruction of key works, and just the shifting sands of artistic taste.
But today, thanks to all that scholarly detective work, he's firmly back where he belongs, standing alongside Robert Campan and Jan van Eyck as one of the absolute pillars, the three greats of early Netherlandish painting.
His story is just such a powerful reminder of how fragile fame can be, how easily even a massive historical figure can be obscured by time and misinformation. He reached the absolute pinnacle of success in his day, yet his identity basically had to be reconstructed centuries later. It's quite humbling, really.
Which leads us to a final thought, something for you, the listener, to consider. We talked about that huge lost masterpiece, The Justice of Trajan and Herkenwald. Four enormous panels, praised by everyone who saw them, holding pride of place in the Brussels town hall for over 200 years.
That visual anchor of his public achievement.
Exactly. So here's the question. If that single, massive, undeniable work hadn't been destroyed in that bombardment in 1695, if it had survived, standing there as constant visible proof of his genius and status, would Roger van der Haven's reputation have ever faded? Would historians have been forced to figure out the name confusion much, much sooner, simply because the evidence of his greatness was too big to ignore?